Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hey everyone, it's The Takeaway from May 23rd. I'm Tanzina Vega.
When you don't have affordable housing being built, we basically are allowing communities to be largely homogenous. So you have economic segregation, racial segregation, and that presents a huge problem.
Today, we take a look at how local zoning laws are essentially blocking affordable housing across the country. Also on the show, we continue our look at life in your 40s. The juggle is real.
Raising children and trying to save the future, it feels like we're just barely treading water.
And why teen movies of today are moving away from the tropes that once dominated the genre. You know the ones.
This is what high school is going to look like. Oh my God, there's the hot girl, and there's the hot guy, and you're going to be smoking, and you're going to be doing this, that, and the other. Well, that was back in my day. Nobody smokes anymore.
All right, let's do it. The American dream is supposed to include kids, a dog, and a home of one's own. But finding that home is a challenge for many lower-income families across the country. Take Connecticut, where wealthy communities are blocking developers from building affordable housing. Local officials say they're preserving the character of the community, but housing advocates say these tactics reinforce and create racially and economically segregated communities. It's a similar story being played out in communities across the country where wealthier residents are saying, not in my backyard, to lower income neighbors. Joining us from Connecticut is Jacqueline Rabe Thomas, a reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, who recently wrote a story about the issue. Welcome to The Takeaway, Jacqueline.
Thanks for having me.
And Malo Hudson is an associate professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. He joins us as well. Malo, thanks for being back with us on The Takeaway.
So glad to be here.
So we have so many questions about this. Malo, let's start with you. What are we talking about when we're talking about affordable housing versus public housing?
Well, that's a very good question. And when we think about affordability, it's really oftentimes looking at area median income. And so looking at who the most vulnerable populations might be when we think about their needs for housing. Public housing is a public type of housing that's managed by the government. And so it's specific requirements to live there. You have to fit within certain requirements that they have, and that's public housing. But oftentimes when we think of affordable housing now, it's really for teachers and civil servants and everyday Americans that pay their taxes because the cost of housing for many people is out of reach.
Now, Malo, just really quickly, do we have a sense of what the supply and demand of affordable housing looks like across the country? Are there more people who need it than actual stock?
Well, the United States is a very diverse place in terms of housing need. But when you think about the coast or places that have strong economies, so your Chicago's of the world, the San Francisco's, the New York's, the Washington, D.C.'s, there's great demand for housing and very little supply to meet that demand.
Jacqueline, you've written about families in Connecticut specifically. Let's talk about who you decided to focus on. Tell me about what these families were experiencing.
So one experience that really stood out to me was that of Ashana Cunningham and her family. You know, she was working her 40-hour job at a daycare, making $14 an hour. And then her wife got sick, and she wasn't able to have a two-income housing. And then all of a sudden, she got into a car accident, and she lost her car, and she didn't have transportation to get to her daycare job. And so she had to stop working for, you know, a month and a half. And by the time she was able to sort of get back on her feet and find another job and, you know, get over some of the obstacles she was facing, she was in a homeless shelter. And she's still struggling to get back on her feet. And she's working full time. She actually has two jobs. She, you know, is making now $12.50 an hour at a daycare, and she's working a second job at Family Dollar for $11 an hour. And for her, the reality is just, you know, just trying to make it paycheck to paycheck. So finding something like buying a home, it's just so far out of her reality.
There are other bigger issues that you also focused on in your piece about Connecticut specifically, and it has to do with zoning. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So Connecticut state law leaves zoning issues to local zoning boards. And so what that means is that local zoning boards get to determine what type of housing opens in their neighborhood. And just to sort of put that in perspective, 3/4 of Connecticut's communities, 123 municipalities, require a special permit, meaning their local zoning board has to approve anything that has multi-units. So anything that has two or three or four units, you know, apartment buildings that are inherently, you know, more affordable for individuals need to go through their zoning boards. And what I found through listening to hours of zoning board meetings are things like, you know, we're concerned that there's no sidewalks on the street to lead to the train station, or it's going to take over the limited open space that we have, or it's going to impact our neighborhood character, or it's going to cause overcrowding. And then, but then when you dive in a little bit deeper, you hear things like the developer saying, okay, let's come up with a plan to develop sidewalks and being shut down. Let's come up with a plan to make this street safer. Let's widen it a little bit and is shut down. So what I found is in the municipalities that I really dove into is that you didn't really find a willing partner to sort of bring these projects to fruition.
We're also going to talk a little bit about what's behind that lack of willingness in a minute. But Malo, I want to bring you back in here because we're talking about Connecticut specifically with Jacqueline, but zoning laws are, you know, across the country. What are the effects, Malo, of this practice of local zoning laws essentially being used to keep affordable housing out? What are the impacts of that?
There are major implications for this, negative implications, especially for lower income, vulnerable populations or communities of color that are looking for quality housing, that are looking for good schools, that want to be in areas that are great for their families. And what when you don't have affordable housing being built, multifamily housing, we basically are allowing communities to be largely homogenous, whether that be along racial and ethnic lines, economic lines. So you have economic segregation, racial segregation, and that presents a huge problem. And if we're to think also about the environmental issues, right? So if you look at places like Connecticut and even in California, where you have zoning ordinances that require an acre to build a home on, right? And so you think about the type of land just to build on, and you have developers saying, we're willing to build dense. We're willing to build different types of housing that would incorporate multiple types of people near transit lines, near public transit, so people can get to work and so forth.
So in Connecticut, I found, speaking to that issue about large acreage, in one southwest town, to build a multi-unit, you need 70 acres in Monroe, wow. Connecticut. In Avon, you need 15. You know, these are things that while on the books, it's, well, you're able to build multi-unit, but what's the practicality of anyone ever actually being able to come to the finish line on building a multi-unit? And you know, that what that's led to is Connecticut has some of the most segregated regions in the country. You know, you talk about where low-income housing is located in Connecticut, and in Bridgeport, one out of every five houses or housing units in Bridgeport is dedicated for low-income residents. In Hartford, it's one in four. You know, go to Westport, it's one in 30. So, you know, these things have real implications. You know, there's different things that happen because of that. Brookings Institution, they found that in order to cross that barrier, to make that move to a higher performing school or to a higher cost area, it costs 3.5 times more. So Ashana Cunningham, the woman I spoke about earlier and her family, it would cost their family $25,000 more to move to a Westport or to a, you know, a higher income area with that it, that has better schools.
And I just want to stress the point that Jacqueline just made, the excellent point of when you see how exclusionary zoning is being used, it contributes to racial and economic segregation, but also can decrease the housing supply, which in turn then leads to higher housing cost, right? So therefore, it's benefiting those who already can afford to own the home, live in these communities. But for people who want to start their lives, start their careers, have young children, it's very difficult to break into these types of communities. And you have to think about the motivations here. And much of it is around protecting housing values, property values, also maintaining the kind of community context that people want, which is code for we like living near similar types of people as ourselves, whether that be affluent, upper middle class, certain racial and ethnic backgrounds. And that's the whole problem with this and the big challenge that we need to fight.
And one of the things that's interesting about this is in your reporting, Jacqueline, there's also a political element to this. And what's interesting is that the Connecticut is one of the, you know, more liberal states in the United States. It's definitely a Democrat run state in many ways. Jacqueline, what does this tell us about these supposedly liberal communities like Westport, where their politics don't seem to line up at the local level as they do, at least on the federal level?
So local authority is part of our tradition here in Connecticut. And overcoming that and asking legislators to sort of say, okay, we're going to take away some of that local authority, you know, how do you think they're going to get reelected? So there's that that's going on. There's that dynamic. In Connecticut, you know, Democrats have run the General Assembly for the last 22 years, the governor's mansion for the last eight. And, you know, in a bipartisan fashion in 2017, they scaled back the laws that helped make it a little bit easier for developers to bypass local zoning rules.
Mala, what are the protections, if any, for low-income Americans who are looking for housing? Are there laws in place that are meant to mitigate this? Are there class action lawsuits that tenants or potential tenants can get together and really do? I mean, it just, and the reason why I ask is because I feel like what happens is these communities then become created, low-income communities become created, and even those communities then risk being gentrified. So it feels like low-income Americans are constantly being pushed around. What does the law say?
Well, we have laws in the books. So even going back to, you know, 1917, where Los Angeles is one of the first cities, actually, to do citywide exclusionary zoning based on race and ethnicity. And we've said that that's illegal. You can't do that. And then we also have the Fair Housing Act of 1968. But the fact of the matter is what we're talking about is implementing the law, right? And so you can have all the laws in the books, but if we're not implementing it and really understanding how it plays out on the ground, it becomes very difficult. And so Jacqueline spoke wonderfully about local control and local authorities and how that can be abused, right? So you can say, well, I live in this community. I want to maintain the character of the community. I want to make sure that the right people live here, and or we're concerned about traffic. These making sure it's not ghettoized. These could be code words, right? And so, how do you then say this is blatant discrimination? Which, you know, in this case, we know it is. You can go on and look at different examples across the country where there's been no affordable housing being built for decades, right? So there's major challenges there. So I think what we have to think about is how do you build the public will? How do you mobilize people to really speak out on these issues? How do you get state legislators and electeds to have basically the strength to stand up and speak out about what is right and to really reframe the discussion and to say, when we're talking about affordable housing, we're talking about for the majority of Americans, right? Look at the housing cost. This is not just a Connecticut issue. It's a New York issue. It's a California issue. I mean, go across the country, right? And so what we have to do is have a broader conversation of talking about housing as a human right. And not a goal, but it's a right for people. And what impacts that has when families can't live in communities, diverse communities, in terms of having affluent people, middle-income people, you know, working-class people. And that, to me, is what we always like to talk about, the American dream. In fact, in reality, it's not happening.
Mala Hudson is an associate professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. And Jacqueline Rabe Thomas is a reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Jacqueline, Mala, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your 40s. It's a decade that gets a lot less attention than some others, I think, and yet it's one where so much is happening in our lives. All week on The Takeaway, we've been looking at slices of this phase of life with our series called The Juggle, and you've been at the heart of it. Today, for the final piece in the series, we turn to family and relationships, and we've heard from you all about it.
The bulk of my 40s was learning to be a mom, be a wife, and all about how to take care of a child who had cognitive and physical disabilities.
I'm 43 years old and had my first baby at 40 and my second at 43. She's now 12 weeks. I wanted a career before I started a family. I'm engaged, but having children was a priority, so we will get married next. Life for me seems to be just beginning.
Raising children and trying to save the future, it feels like we're just barely treading water. It puts a strain on our relationship. Thank goodness we have great communication, but as costs increase and wages don't seem to match those increased costs, it becomes more and more difficult.
Thanks to you all for sharing your stories with us. And today we have writer Glynis McNichol, with us in the studio to talk about her experience coming into her 40s and how it changed the relationships in her life, and also what she's learned from so many others about this decade. She's the author of No One Tells You This, a memoir. Glynis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your book is titled No One Tells You This. What is it that no one tells you?
So everything it felt like when I got to my 40s, it felt like I had been prepared for everything to be terrible, but not in the ways it was actually difficult. And nobody had prepared me for it to be wonderful, which I spent the first year when I turned 40 being so resentful about, that no one had said, wow, this could be great. Here's the things you should think about to deal with that. So I felt deeply unprepared on every level.
Turning 40 wasn't, that was actually great for me. It was everything after that. The year after, I was like, wait, what happened? And I kind of felt the same way, that no one really tells you or really talks about this decade in particular other than the negative. One thing we often hear about when especially when I made the call out to people on Twitter, was 40s often means, and family often means kids, but that's not the case for everybody. Tell us about your experience.
So one of the things I really struggled with was I wasn't married and I didn't have children, and it just felt like I had completely fallen off the map of any narrative we have around particularly women's lives. And the truth is, I sort of joke, somebody asked me to describe myself as child-free, and I was
writing. I don't know about that word.
I know. I think we really have a dearth of language around this experience altogether. But I was writing back to them as I had my niece and nephews crawling over me, and I was organizing a baby shower for someone, and I thought, your relationships in your 40s become so intense and complicated and intricate. And I think in this generation, we are support systems for each other in ways that we haven't figured out how to talk about properly.
One of the things you've said when you're talking to one of our producers is that it's very difficult to operate when you're not seen by a culture. What does that mean?
I think without recognition, how do you know your place in the world? And how do other people value you when there's no ritual to celebrate your own life? I think invisibility on every level is the worst punishment. And how do you measure your own progress and your place in the world without it? And I find that I find that difficult, and I still struggle with that.
I think it's something that you brought up really, really interestingly, because a lot of it does have to do with where do you fit into these bigger themes of marriage if you're not married, mm-hmm. having children if you don't have children, and then being the dreaded 40-something, right? Mm-hmm. All of those things. I'm in the same position. Mm-hmm. All those things collide. And it does feel like we're not seen mm-hmm. by culture.
Even when you're exhausted by all the roles you're playing, of course, you're playing so many roles. And when you're not seen, there's no way to talk about how difficult it is. And there's no way to talk about how wonderful it is either.
Right.
Which is really, really difficult. We have celebrations for a reason. We have rituals for a reason. And when you have none, which is what happens after 40 without a wedding and without a baby, particularly for women, it's like, where am I going? What am I doing?
Let's talk about the things that, even if we don't have kids ourselves, how many roles we play in our 40s in other people's lives. Talk about that.
Well, I think in my experience, most of my friends have children, and most of my friends had children in their late 30s. Their family lives at some distance, which I think is becoming the norm. And what happens, and what has happened to me, is you become the support system, you become the fill-in, you become sort of the emergency childcare call. You are the person that goes and meets them when they come home from the hospital, or changes the diapers, or whatever it happens to be. And I'm so grateful for that, because I quite enjoy playing that role. What is difficult about it is when that role isn't seen. And I think women are struggling with this conversation of motherhood versus not motherhood. And mothers are overwhelmed for a variety of reasons that we could talk at length about. And there's this assumption of, oh, you have so much free time, or, oh, you get to do what you want. And I've encountered that in very intense situations where I was overwhelmed helping other people with their lives and dealing with this sort of dismissive nature of, oh, you don't do anything. And I just
because
think,
you don't have kids,
because
or
you
because
don't,
you're
yes.
not. Yeah, I find that is a really frustrating point, mm-hmm. Because I think that in my personal experience, it feels like when I say no, that's often not accepted because it's assumed that I have time. Mm-hmm. But if I said no, I have to do something for my kids, I think it would be taken differently. Do you agree?
Oh, my God. Of course. And I do think that comes back to, we really recognize women's value the most around motherhood. And so when we don't recognize any other version of a woman's life, we're so just so easily dismissive of how you're spending your time or the quality of your time or your right to your own time, really.
Let's talk about other types of relationships, romantic partnerships, which are just so easy at this stage. So, I mean, I feel like, tell me if I'm wrong here. I think that what happens at this age is that people will often stop introducing you as often as they may have prior, or you're getting filtered out of dating algorithms because your age cutoff is over 39. I mean, are these things, or you're the old lady cat spinster? Like, you know, why are we still stuck in these tropes? And is that wrong? I mean, is there this robust dating world out there for women and men in their 40s?
I think both. If that's, okay. I know that's okay. A frustrating answer.
I'll take it.
I find that when I want to date, there's certainly a world out there of people who are eager to date. I think it looks a lot different. Oftentimes you are dating people who are coming out of marriages, who have children, and that's a much different dynamic. I find that I quite like to be alone, which I think is a justifiable way to want to exist. It's funny, the further I get into my 40s, the less questions I am asked about, like, oh, don't worry, it'll still happen.
Is it because they don't care? I'm wondering if that's what it is.
I think it's a combination of you sort of have moved off their relevance map, but it's also so many of my friends, I think, I don't want to single out any friends, but like, at this age, many of your friends are in the deep end of their own marriages, and maybe they're coming out of those marriages, and those marriages are dissolving. And I find that I am a emotional support system to many people, and also increasingly an example of why it's not so scary. And so that's been my experience. And none of my friends, and I think if you're in the position where your friends are making you feel bad about your life, it's time to reassess those friendships. But none of my friends have ever spoken to me as if my life is less interesting or worthwhile or somehow missing. I think I am fortunate to have friendships that really value the way I live and value the place I have in their lives.
And also wondering whether or not you are hearing themes that emerge when I talk to friends that, because I have very close friends that are married, have kids, some that don't, but there seem to be similar themes throughout this decade. And I think caregiving in particular was one that seemed to span across everybody, particularly parents. Mm-hmm. You took care of your mother for a while. Tell me about that.
My mother was diagnosed with Parkinson's and then dementia, and her decline was very swift. And my sister has 3 small children at the time. And I ended up flying back and forth to Toronto, where my mother lived, to sort out care, to provide care, to navigate through the system of getting her the attention she needed, which is overwhelming for anyone who's done it. It's such a difficult, emotionally difficult place to be. And again, I think until we recognize the heavy lift that is, it's hard to provide support for the people in it. I was just overwhelmed for the year I turned 40, caretaking other people's lives and providing that support.
And off of that, another thing that came up on Twitter about this conversation was setting boundaries. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is about saying no. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, particularly in your 40s.
I sometimes think by the time you're in your 40s, you've hopefully navigated like the physical nutrition and exercise that you need and what works for you. And in the same way, hopefully you're in a place where you know emotionally the exercise and nutrition and stuff you need. And that really entails understanding how many people you can have in your life, who you can have in your life, and how much you can do and provide other people. And then learning to say no and not feeling shame around it, I think, is the thing. And for women, that is just particularly hard. And as you noted earlier, when you aren't a parent, the expectation around your time can be overwhelming. And the language around your life when you don't participate quickly slides into selfish or spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
That's unfair.
Let's end the segment. If you had to give a name to the decade and the relationships that define it, what do you call it?
I keep thinking this decade is the heroic decade, that you've spent those, if you go back to Joseph Campbell's hero's myth, you spend the decades up to me being sort of given the tools you need and the tasks you need, and this is where it all comes into play. It's such an intense decade where everything is coming at you. It's extraordinary, and the fact we don't talk about it in those terms really diminishes the experience. But it feels to me really heroic.
I'm going to put on my super cape right now. Glynis McNichol is a writer and author of No One Tells You This, a memoir. Thank you so much, Glynis.
Thank you.
Ah, high school, a time when teenagers get to make new friends, learn important life lessons, and panic after realizing they have 24 hours or less to have fun. Okay, that last one might only happen in the movies.
We only have one night left to have studied and partied in high school. Otherwise, we're just gonna be the girls that missed out. We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Okay, we've broken a lot of rules. One, we have fake IDs.
Fake college IDs so we can get into their 24-hour library.
Name one person whose life was so much better because they broke a couple of rules.
Picasso.
Yes, he broke art rules. Name a person who broke a real rule.
Rosa Parks.
Name another
one. Susan B. Anthony.
Damn it.
That was Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever in a scene from Booksmart, actor Olivia Wilde's directorial debut. The movie follows two straight-A students as they attempt to make up for the 4 years of excitement they missed out on in just one night. And while the plot isn't exactly groundbreaking, I have two guests here who say that Booksmart does represent a bit of a new direction in teen movies. With me in studio are Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, and Allison Wilmore, critic and culture writer for BuzzFeed News. Great to have you both back.
Hey there.
Hey, Tanzina.
That clip was actually hilarious. I have not seen the film yet. You both have seen Booksmart. Allison, the trailers make it look like a very female-centric Superbad, is it?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to kind of summarize it. You know, it follows the same kind of pattern of like, what, this crazy night, you're looking for a party. But at the same time, it's got this very kind of female angle to it, especially in its depiction of its friendship, which I really liked.
And Rafer, it's not necessarily, as we mentioned, the most original idea, but were there things about the film that felt fresh to you?
Yeah, I think among them, that friendship, it's really strong and interesting because it's a gay-straight friendship. The Amy character is out, gay. Molly, the sort of more aggressive one that we hear there, is straight. But they have this really great sisterly bond. And it's really interesting to me that this film takes place in sort of the new America, or perhaps at least what we'd like to think is the new America, this sort of generation of millennials where this stuff is okay. That certainly would not have been back in my day, for instance. You know, I think I grew up in a rather feral world of you know, bullies and delinquents, and there's none of that in this. You know, the social cliques are very fluid. You know, the skater girls are hanging out with the cool guys, and everyone's kind of okay. The bathrooms are co-ed. People are still drawing obscene graffiti on the walls, but the bathrooms are co-ed. And it's really interesting to watch all this unfold and to see the problems that these kids still kind of do have, but to also see kind of how far they've come.
What's also interesting is what you mentioned, Rafer, is that these two friends, one is gay, one is straight, we don't see that a lot. Allison, what did you think about that?
Well, I think that it's really lovely in the way it handles that because it's both very open about their friendship and their dynamic. And at the same time, you have this character whose story is not about coming out, which is often still the arc that a queer character has on screen.
So true.
You know, she's out. She's comfortable with that. She gets to have just like the usual kind of awkward teen first romantic fumblings, you know? And I think a lot of her drama comes from just being shy and being kind of not sure of herself and how to approach her crush. And I thought there was something really nice about just kind of skipping over that whole kind of arc to be like, we're already here. Let's see where it goes from here.
What about when it comes to the race of the characters here? In Booksmart, the two leading characters, at least, are two white girls. And kind of what you're saying is like this very like wonderful place where everyone sort of gets along and there are really no major issues. And like you said, co-ed bathrooms and everyone is open and out. That's also kind of not realistic, right? And it's kind of, I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think particularly in terms of the racial demographics and in terms of representation, I think you're seeing these movies very slowly move into doing something a little better. You know, I think even in Booksmart, which is a movie I like a lot, it's mostly the characters on the side that happen to be characters of color. You know, the school heartthrob or the kind of stoner goofball. And it's been nice to see those characters be accepted as like these very popular kids in class and like to not have that necessarily be a point of conversation. At the same time, you do feel that these changes are happening incrementally and that we still kind of have a ways to go to really feel like it's broken open, like old patterns.
And of course, there is another player in this space, which is little old Netflix, who themselves have been churning out a couple of teen movies over the past couple of years. And I guess To All the Boys I Loved Before is probably the one that's the most popular. But how do these stack up to what is happening in theaters, Allison?
Well, I think it's important to point out that a lot of these theatrical movies we're talking about are R-rated. You know, so many of these movies that I have loved, like Edge of 17 was another great kind of underappreciated teen movie that's rated R as well. Like, I kind of wonder who the audience, the intended audience is, because I feel like that kind of signals that they're not counting on teens. They're counting on, like, us to go, you know, and talk about, how great this
is. Non-teens.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that teen movies on the big screen haven't always performed so well recently. Teens are coming out to see superhero movies, but, like, to have a big teen movie hit, that's been really tricky recently, whereas Netflix seems to have had no problem.
Yeah, and I think Netflix is also, though, just to rag on Netflix a little bit, if I may.
You may.
I think they are also, the bar is pretty low on Netflix movies. I mean, I think those movies are kind of underproduced, underwritten. Not a lot of money has been spent on them. I find that they often have a very good, solid, catchy premise and probably a pretty good cast and a not that great script and not that high of a production
budget. Why do you think that is, though? Is that just because Netflix is trying to expand the playing field and by doing so is coming up against those obstacles?
No, I think they're trying to crush, destroy, and own the playing field by flooding the market with literally 80 to 90 of these things a year. And I think they're probably going to succeed. So I'm knocking Netflix, but I also just want to say that, you know, they can kind of churn these things out the way that television has always churned out content, which is pretty quickly, relatively cheaply. And also, anecdotally, I do feel like people really watch these Netflix movies. You hear people talk about them a lot, but Netflix does not release actual numbers. There is no third party that tracks them, and we don't actually know. So when Netflix says, you know, X movie is our most watched ever, we really just have to take their word for it. There's no Nielsen rating. There's no one who actually is going to tell us whether it is or isn't.
That's an interesting point as well. And I'm wondering, you know, I want to go back to something you said, Allison, earlier, which was sort of this idea that the characters in Booksmart, whether they happen to be gay or of color, is almost just, it's not an issue, right? It's just part of their who they are. I find that refreshing. I think that, you know, we talk a lot about diversity and inclusion, and then it feels ham-handed or heavy-handed, right? We're going to put this person here because they are that. And I think that's one of the things that's missing in a lot of these films. But I'm curious to know what you all think Hollywood could do better, Netflix could do better in terms of speaking to teens in their coverage or in their films.
For Netflix in particular, you know, I think there's a lot of benefit for Netflix for having these movies feel familiar, you know, that like that fits their algorithm. It also seems to fit what people want from them. Like they feel a little comforting. You haven't seen them before, but they've got a lot of elements that you kind of know to expect. And I think, you know, with something like To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which was a big hit for them, or at least according to their own metrics, which they didn't tell us, that it's a movie where, you know, the kind of progressive aspect is that you have an Asian American lead, but you don't have anything else really changed. And so, you know, you're kind of like, wow, that's so great that to see this Asian American actress in the lead, but her love interest is still like the hot white jock who is Noah Centineo, who became a kind of like phenomenon for Netflix, you know, and you still have a lot of the same trappings, the same dynamics. And so I feel like sometimes I just feel impatient with that to be like, why is it that we have to always do this like one step at a time? Why is it that we can't like just do something that feels a little wilder, a little off the books?
Allison Wilmore is a critic and culture writer for BuzzFeed News, and Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and here for us at The Takeaway, and we appreciate you both so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Hey, folks, I've got some news to share. We're coming up on 1 year that I've been hosting Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway, and we want to celebrate. We're going to broadcast from WNYC's The Green Space in New York City on Friday, May 31st at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And the conversation will be all about the Electoral College. So visit thegreenspace.org/events to secure your seat. That's green, spelled G-R-E-E-N-E. We'll see you there.